Thank you, Mrs. White, for the beautiful special music. That's very meaningful words and very beautifully interpreted. Thank you. I'd like to thank the Kellys for the invitation to come and spend the weekend with you. We've heard things about the Super Social, of course, but it's the first time that my wife and I have been able to come, and we really enjoyed everything so far, starting out last night, and I know there's a lot of fun yet ahead. I would like to thank, I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of everybody, thank the ladies for the meals that you prepared today. I know a lot of preparation went into that, and enjoyed what we had at lunch, and looking forward to dinner tonight as well. Thank you for the decorations, whoever had a hand in that. The flowers are very beautiful up here, and I know there's a lot of work that goes in behind the scenes preparing for the technical things and setting up the hall and all of that. So thanks to everybody who helped make the weekend possible. I found in preparing the subject that I have for you today that a very interesting and thought-provoking introduction can come from a song. So I'd like to ask now the tech people please to play the song, and hopefully we can get the lyrics up on the wall so you can follow along. They're not hard to understand, but you might want to read them as we go and think about them, and we're going to talk about this subject today. So please go ahead and play that song now. I found that to be a very thought-provoking song, lots of things to think about in there. I'm sure in an audience this size or a congregation this size, there are no doubt some of you who have had to deal with a situation similar to that. Maybe some of you are dealing with something like that right now, a time when you have come face to face with questions of your own mortality, or perhaps face to face with the question of a loved one's mortality, the realization that the end of this physical life may not be so very far into the future. Now, I need to state up front that I'm not suggesting that any of you take up rodeo riding or start mountain climbing, although the Kellys, my wife and myself, will be skydiving tomorrow. But the Bible does tell us that there is wisdom in considering how short the human life truly is. And there is wisdom in living each day of the life that God gives us in the light of that realization. And the Bible actually speaks quite a bit about this question and the wisdom to be learned from it. Let's start looking at this topic in 2 Kings chapter 20, if you would. 2 Kings chapter 20. We have an interesting episode from the life of King Hezekiah here. And we learn that Hezekiah was told that he was going to die of an illness. He had a terminal illness, and he was told to set his house in order. It's quite interesting how this unfolded and what Hezekiah learned from this experience. 2 Kings chapter 20, starting in verse 1. 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 1. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, went to him and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live." That's kind of a bit of overkill, I think. Not only are you going to die, but you're not going to live either. And he turned his face toward the wall, and he prayed the Lord, saying, "Remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart, and have done what was good in your sight." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then it happened, before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court, that the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David your father, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears. Surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord. And I will add to your days 15 years, and I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. And I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." And God did. He healed him. He heard his prayer. He lifted him up. He gave him 15 more years. He delivered him and the city from their enemies. And that is not only that's not the only interesting part of this story. It's interesting to see how God hears the prayers of his faithful servants and that he does heal. He changes the way things like that turn out. But we also have an account in the book of Isaiah. In fact, the verses that we just read are actually preserved also in the book of Isaiah. Start turning to chapter 38, if you would, please. Isaiah chapter 38, starting in verse 9. Isaiah 38, verse 9. The verses that we just read in 2 Kings 20 are found in the first part of Isaiah chapter 38. But then we have Hezekiah's musings on the experience that he had just gone through. And that's what we have in verse 9. It says, "This is the writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and recovered from his sickness." So this is what he said. He said, "In the prime of my life I shall go to the gates of Sheol. I'm deprived of the remainder of my years." He was thinking, "I'm too young for this. This is happening out of time. I expected to have more years than the years that I have. I'm being cut off in the middle. I'm being deprived. I should have a right to more years than what I'm being given." And that leads us to the realization that we really, none of us know how long a time we have. Accidents occur, illnesses occur. We may think, we all probably imagine, well, I should have 70 or 80 years, and maybe that will be true. We hope it is for all of us. But it may not be true. And there are exceptions to the average lifespan of people. Things happen. It's uncertain how much time we have. None of us really knows how much time we have. Verse 11, "I said, I shall not see Yah, the Lord, in the land of the living. I shall observe man no more among the inhabitants of the world." He reflected on the value of friendships and relationships. "I'm not going to be able to converse or discuss or share things with people anymore. I'm going to be deprived of that." Verse 12, "My lifespan is gone, taken from me like a shepherd's tent." Shepherds traveled fast and light, so their tents were quickly taken up, put up and taken down, and were easy to transport. And he felt like his life was that. It was just being taken down like a pup tent. "I have cut off my life like a weaver. He cuts me off from the loom." When weavers got to the end, they just trimmed that last cord, neatened everything up, and it was over in a second to cut that cord. And he felt that's what was happening to him. "From day until night, you make an end of me. I have considered until morning. Like a lion, so he breaks all my bones. From day until night, you make an end of me." He probably was feeling some pain. He was feeling fear, certainly, in this illness. And there is physical discomfort that comes with some physical illnesses that we have, some diseases. "Like a crane or a swallow, so I chattered. I mourned like a dove. My eyes fail from looking upward, looking to God." And sometimes the answer takes a while before it comes. "O Lord, I am oppressed. Undertake for me. Please intervene. What shall I say? He has both spoken to me, and he himself has done it. I appealed to him, and he heard my prayer. He undertook for me, just like I asked him." God hears the prayers of his servants, and he acts on those prayers. Then he says, "I shall walk carefully all my years." Having a close encounter with an end of our physical lives teaches us to have a new perspective about things. It gives us a different a point of view about things. We look at our lives differently. "I shall walk carefully all my years in the bitterness of my soul." That is, there was a calm, solemn, submissive way to live his life. He learned to walk more carefully in tune with God's will. His priorities were different. "O Lord, by these things men live, and in these things is the life of my spirit. So you will restore me and make me live." Look at verse 17. It seems rather surprising when we first read it. "Indeed, it was for my own peace that I had great bitterness." There is a peace that comes from having faced a situation like this. And if you've talked with people, you ever talked with people who have faced such a situation and have recovered, they will tell you that looking back on it, they were very enriched and they grew in maturity by having faced and encountered such a difficult situation. "It was for my own peace that I had to go through that bitter period in my life. But you have lovingly delivered my soul from the pit of corruption. You have cast all my sins behind your back. You healed me, though I really had no right to ask it of you. For Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your truth. The living man, he shall praise you as I do this day. The father shall make known your truth to the children." Hezekiah intended to try to teach this important truth to his children, and maybe his children's children. "The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore we will sing my songs with stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Lord." Some commentators feel like this was a poem or a song. It was actually set to music, and that Hezekiah had this song sung on the anniversary of his healing every year, because he didn't want to forget this important lesson, this important element of wisdom in the human life of realizing how brief our existence truly is. Facing the possibility of death focuses the attention of human beings like nothing else does. You ever talk to a veteran of a war who came face to face with a situation where it could have been life or death in a moment? They never, ever forget those times. They are burned deeply into their memories. The man of God, Moses, also reflected on this principle. I'd like to ask you to turn back to the Psalms now, Psalm 90. You probably know most of the Psalms were either composed or collected by David. Perhaps Solomon had something to do with it too. But not all of the Psalms were written at that time period. In fact, this is the oldest of the Psalms, we believe. It is labeled as a Psalm of Moses. So this goes back to the time when the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt. It seems to fit with the period of time when the Israelites had rebelled after the bad report of the spies that were sent into the Promised Land. And there was the realization that that whole generation was going to die in the desert. They were never going to get to enter the Promised Land that they had so looked forward to. That may be where this came from. Let's start reading in verse 1 of Psalm 90. You notice before the psalm begins, it says, "A prayer of Moses, the man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had informed the earth of the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man to destruction and say, 'Return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. You carry them away like a flood, they are like sheep. In the morning they are like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up, and in the evening it is cut down and withered. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. In all our days we have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow. For it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So, verse 12, teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. What does it mean to number our days? Can we even number our days? How can we know? How could we possibly count them? We don't know in advance how many days we're going to have. So how can we number them? Well, one thing we can certainly do is realize that however many days we have, it's not going to be very many. And when you talk to somebody who's older, someone with gray hair, and they're getting on up into years, and you ask them about how long life is, they will tell you it is really, really short. You probably, some of the young people here are thinking, "Oh no, 70 years, that's a long time, man." You know, from my perspective, that just seems like I've got eternity almost before me. I realize some point is going to end, but that's a long way away. And that's what everybody thinks in their youth. And then as time goes on, and you get farther and farther along, and you look back on it, especially people who are approaching their 70 years or 80 years, they look back and they think, "Wow, where did that go? How could that have gone by so quickly?" It's been said that inside of every older person, there's a young person wondering, what happened? And that's true. None of us feels old, at least not in our minds. He goes by very quickly. Moses lived to be 120 years, so he was an exception to this case of 70 or maybe 80 years. But Moses would have said that even with his 120 years, there was a lot of labor and sorrow in the life that he lived. And that's part of the life we have. It's there to teach us lessons that we're going to take with us through eternity. David, King David, reflected on this same topic a number of times. David was a soldier from his youth. He faced death many times, and not only in battle, but at other times as well. When Saul was pursuing him one time in 1 Kings chapter 20, he told Jonathan, "There is but a step between me and death." He knew that taking a wrong turn or going the wrong direction could have meant the end of his physical existence. Psalm 39. Let's look at Psalm 39. David understood well the brevity of life and the precarious nature of it, and how that should help us keep a proper perspective on the way we spend the time that we have. Psalm 39, starting in verse 1. Psalm of David. "I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle. You know, I'm just not going to say anything. Because if I said something, I probably would say the wrong thing the way I feel right now. I probably would criticize God for the situation that I find myself in. I'm not going to say anything while the wicked are before me, because it looks like things are working out a lot better for them than it is for me. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue, Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. When the temptation is there to get frustrated with God because he's doing things the way we don't think he should do it, David has a proper response to that. Rather than complain about what God's doing, we should think about how frail we are and how short a time we are on this earth. And yet, what important things we have to accomplish with the time he gives us. And he will give us the time necessary to achieve the goals that he has set for us. Verse 5. Indeed, you have made my days as a handbreadth, and my age is nothing before you. Certainly, every man at his best state. So even if we have the longest life you can imagine, and the best life that we can imagine as a human being, every man at his best state is but a vapor. Really doesn't last very long. You know what a vapor is, right? You step out of your house on a cold morning and you breathe. There's that vapor that's there for a moment, and then it's gone. David said, that's what my life is like. That's the best we can hope for. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them. That's what a lot of people pursue today. They're trying to gain material wealth. And they're going to leave it all to somebody else, and they're not going to know what happens to it, what someone does with it, what foolish things people are going to buy with the money that they've heaped up for themselves. And now, Lord, what do I wait for? What makes it all worthwhile to go through this short life? He said, my hope is in you. And that's really the only place that there is hope. Our hope must be in God. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the reproach of the foolish. I was mute. I did not open my mouth because it was you who did it. Remove your plague from me. I'm consumed by the blow of your hand. When with rebukes you correct me for iniquity, you make my beauty melt away like a moth. Surely every man is a vapor. Selah. I'm sure you know Selah in the Psalms means pause. It can be a musical term, like a pause. Or you pause in the music. But in the Psalms, it means perhaps a pause in the music, but it certainly means a pause in reading through this psalm. It means stop and think about what you just read. Pause. Mull that over. Chew on that for a while. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I'm a stranger with you, a sojourner, that means someone who's just passing through, as were all my fathers, as we all are. We're just passing through. Remove your gaze from me that I may regain strength before I go away and am no more. That's human life. It's a struggle for us to keep the proper perspective in the difficulties and the struggles in life. And we all face them. They're not all the same. They come at different times in life. But we all face similar struggles, difficulties, trials. And it is a struggle for all of us, I put myself first in line, to keep the proper perspective in those times. Let's look at another psalm before we move to another book. Psalm 118. Psalm 118, verse 24. Psalm 118, verse 24. Another psalm to consider, another verse to consider in the context of what we're looking at today. This is the day which the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Every day of life that we have is a gift from God. He didn't need to create us, didn't need to make us and put us here on the earth, didn't need to allow us to see the light of day. But he has. And he's given us days of time and lots of wonderfully positive things that have brightened the days that we spend on earth. And so it is wisdom for us to learn to appreciate every day of life that God gives us, and to focus on the good things, to focus on the bountiful blessings that God gives us and the future for which He's preparing us. This life is brief, the Bible tells us, and yet God, in the brief period of time that we walk the earth, He can change us to the point where He can grant us eternity. That's amazing when you think about it. In a short span of a human life, God can develop His character in us to the point where He will trust us with eternity. It's incredible, really. Let's move farther, a little forward now, to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, as we continue looking at this topic. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, starting in verse 5. The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. All the things that seem so important to human beings, when they draw their last breath, that all goes away. Those strong passions and feelings and things that had them so riled up during their lifetime, that all just goes away. It ends. The memory of them is forgotten. Ultimately, that's true. Not for a few generations. We may remember our grandparents, maybe our great-grandparents. What do you know of your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents? Now, their memory is pretty much perished. Not in God's mind, but from the earth, we don't remember them anymore. So, nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Verse 7. So go, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. If you're living your life the right way, you don't have to worry over much about the brevity of life. If you're pursuing correct priorities, the other things will kind of sort themselves out. Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all of these things will be given to you. Many other things will sort themselves out as long as God has accepted your ways. You're living in accordance with His will. Let your garments be white. Let your head lack no oil. Enjoy the simple pleasures of life. Enjoy clean clothes. Enjoy good food. Enjoy wine. Enjoy company. Enjoy those things. Take advantage of them. Verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. It's interesting how he slips that in now and again. And the point between this word about this word vain there is that if you're living only for the physical life that we have now, that's really vain. Because it's not going to last, first of all, and it's not really going to satisfy. So, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which is given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where, in case you missed it, you are going. That's our destination after this final life. That's where we're all going. Live life to the full, he said. Take advantage of it. Enjoy the good things. But realize that if you live only for this life, it's going to be vain. It's going to turn out to be vanity. Physical existence is a vapor. It's going to pass quickly. There must be something more. And we must live our lives in that realization that we're living for something more than simply what we have in life. Abraham Lincoln said, "In the end, it's not the years in your life that count. It's the life in your years." In other words, it's not how long a life you have, really, in the final analysis that counts, as much as what you do with the time you have, using your years wisely. There was a famous historic symbol that was used in ancient times to express moderation. It's possible that you've still seen it around. Some families still use it as a crest. It is a symbol of a dolphin twisted around an anchor. This device was inscribed on coins by the Emperor Titus of Rome. And it was meant by him to be an expression of the importance of balance between hurry and delay. The failure that comes from rushing too quickly and making a big mistake, and the failure on the other side of delaying so long that we miss a wonderful opportunity that might not come our way again. The anchor is the symbol of delay. It's what slows down or stops a ship. The dolphin at the time was seen as the most quick, the fastest of all the sea creatures. So you have a mix of delay and haste or speed. Sometimes the dolphin and the anchor I mentioned are used as family crest, and oftentimes it comes with a Latin motto, festina lente, which means hasten slowly. Hasten slowly. I think it's interesting to think about that in the way we live our lives. We should live them to the full, but we should also live them in a very pondered manner. We think about what we do. We think about why we do what we do. What is our motivation? What are we attempting to achieve? What is most important to us? It tells us that we should think about what you're doing, about what we're doing, and not waste time on futilities. Not waste time on futilities. Actions express priorities, said Mohandas Gandhi. And that's true. Action expresses priorities. What we do stems from a priority that we have in our lives. So we should examine our lives and say, what are the actions? What do I do with my time? And what does that say about my priorities? What do I do with my time? My wife and I had an interesting experience a couple of years ago. We had a lady, a member of the church that we have known from an African country. I won't give too much information about it. But she had the opportunity to visit the United States for the graduation of one of her children who was going to school. And we had her over to our house for a few hours and a meal. And so she spent the day with us, and she observed my wife working in a typical American kitchen. And it really wasn't much. It was a small house, not very updated and all that. But she was amazed to see the labor-saving devices that my wife had in the kitchen. Apparently, it's one of the first times she'd really had a good look at one. She saw that she had a stovetop where you just turn the dial and the heating element worked. You didn't have to go outside and light the charcoal to cook dinner like this lady did. And then there was an oven. She'd never had anything like that, maybe something like a Dutch oven. That would have been about the best she could do. She saw that we had a fairly large, not huge, but fairly large American-sized refrigerator. It would hold enough food for 2 weeks, maybe more. She didn't have to go to the store. She didn't have to go to the marketplace every day to shop for food. She could do it once, bring it all home in the car, put it in the fridge, and she doesn't have to worry about food for weeks. There's a freezer there that will keep meat almost indefinitely. That's something they don't have in Africa. Then she saw my wife in preparing for different things. There was a microwave. She needed to heat something up quickly, stick it in there, push the button. 1 minute later, that cup of water is boiling. She saw my wife get out the vacuum cleaner to give the rug a once-over. She looked at that astonished. You mean you don't have to carry the rug outside, drape it over a branch, and hit it with a stick to get the dust out? You just waft that thing over it? Incredible. And then after the meal, and this was probably the point that stuck the most with us, after the meal, my wife put the dishes in our old dishwasher. And this lady observed my wife doing that, and she came to her afterwards. She said, you know, I'm going to have my husband build me one of those. So that is a great idea. When you're finished with guests, you just put all the dirty dishes in there, out of sight, until your guests leave. Then you can take them out and wash them. That's a great idea. And my wife said, well, actually, it's a machine that washes and dries the dishes. Her jaw dropped. And then she said to my wife, what do you do with all your time? Because this lady's time, all day, every day, was taken up doing all those things by hand. She had to light the charcoal. She had to actually physically walk to the market to buy the food for the day or for maybe 2 days. She had to beat the rug with a stick if she had a rug. All of these things had to be done by hand. And my wife's just doing it with a snap of her fingers. And she was amazed, and she couldn't imagine, what would I do with all of that time? It stunned her. That's a good question for us to ask ourselves. What do we do with all our time? Now, you're probably thinking, well, I don't have that much time. I'm busy from morning till night. In fact, I'm too busy. Well, that may be true, but according to the U.S. Department of Labor, you have a lot of free time. That is, not necessarily time that's not occupied, but where you have the freedom to decide what you're going to do with it. You're not forced. You're not working. It's not 9 to 5. It's not something that you have to do. You choose what to do with that time. And the choices we make with our time express our priorities. So what do we do with our time? Most Americans waste a lot of time. You know what? Most Americans spend their free time, that is time where they get to decide what to do with it, they spend it on entertainment. not bettering themselves, not learning something useful, not doing something that will help them advance in a career or something else of that nature. Now, sometimes we do that. But most people watch cat videos on the internet or DVDs, or they're on Netflix, or they're watching something on Facebook, and they're talking to friends whom they don't even know who they are, communicating back and forth, etc., etc. You get the picture. We fill our days. In fact, you're probably not getting enough sleep if you're like the average American, but we're filling it with stuff that, for most people on average, really is not important. It's not adding anything to who we are. There's no progress there. We're just marking time. And yet we have so little of it. We have so little of it. Action expresses priorities. So what priorities is your life expressing? I can't answer that for you, but I can encourage you to ask the question yourself and give it some thought. Look at your average day. What do you do with the time that you have? Turn the page over to Ecclesiastes 11, if you would. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, says in Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. Youth is a time to be enjoyed. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. So youth is a time when we should explore and learn about life. We should try different things. Youth is a wonderful time when we are almost, we feel at least, virtually indestructible. We can live on 4 hours of sleep and nothing but pizza. And we do great. We don't get sick. No, we can do all sorts of things when we're young. And God made it that way. And he said we should rejoice in the time of our youth. That's a special time. At the same time, it doesn't mean we can do absolutely anything without consequences. Because, he says, do all of this, walk in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all this, God will bring you into judgment. God is going to expect from every human being an accounting of how he used his time on earth. And especially those who understand what God's plan is and why we're here on earth. He's going to ask us, he's going to call us into account for what we do. And I thought to myself sometimes, I've said, you know, I really wouldn't like to stand before Jesus Christ when he's looking at my life at the record and he would say, that's it? That's all you did? I gave you X amount of years and that's all you've got to show for it? That would be a sad thing, wouldn't it? That's not something that we want to have happen, where God would tell us, you know, you really wasted a lot of time on futilities. You didn't number your days the way you should have. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Know that God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. Don't get mixed up in things that will harm you in your life or maybe shorten your life. For childhood and youth, there's that word again, are vanity. They go by really quickly. And it doesn't seem that way. I remember very well when, you know, 70 years seemed like that could be forever. I remember when a summer day seemed like a week. You remember that when you were 6, 7, 8 years old? All the things you could do in one summer day, it just seemed to go on forever. And now I don't see the days go by. It's just the weeks are flying by like minutes. It goes quickly. You won't stay young. And some of the choices that young people make as young people are going to have a major impact on other parts of their lives. You can make mistakes in your youth that will close off a lot of opportunities for you in the future. You can also set a firm foundation in your youth that's going to propel you far forward in the future. How we use our time has consequences. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the matter. The matter was, to Solomon, how can I live my life to be the happiest? And he was kind of thinking mostly on a physical level. You know, what can I do? What sorts of activities? What kinds of pleasures? What is going to make me happiest? And if you look through Ecclesiastes, he tried all sorts of things. He had the arts. He had musicians. He had dancers. He had food. He had, you know, 1,000 women that he was married to. He tried everything that could be tried. And here's his conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. That is your number one priority. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's what's going to count. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. Now, thankfully, as Christians, we can go to God and repent of what is evil. And He wipes that away, and it will never be seen again. But He does expect an accounting, and He's going to go over the books with us someday. The conclusion of the matter for the wisest man who ever lived, aside from Jesus Christ, was keep your priorities straight. Focus every day on doing what's most important. Fear God and do what He says. Of course, this concept is echoed in the New Testament. We would expect it to be so in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32. If in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, apparently that's something that happened to Paul. Under some persecution or another, he was put in an arena in Ephesus. And I've been to Ephesus, I've seen some of those arenas. I wonder if Paul fought with wild animals here, or did it happen over in this other arena? It was quite a big city. But he's indicating that that actually happened to him sometime. What did he have to fight against? I don't know. That would be interesting to know. But he said, even if I've done something like that, even if I've done exploits, if the dead don't rise, then what good is it? If there is no life after this life, if there is no reward that comes to us from God, what's the use? Eat and drink. Tomorrow we die. Eat, drink, and be merry, as we sometimes say. If there is no God, and if we're not pursuing the values of God, and we're not doing what is necessary to prepare us for the life to come, then that's all there is. Just live for the moment. And as we're reading, that moment is going to go by very quickly. Matthew chapter 7. Let's look at something that Jesus said about this. Matthew chapter 7. This is really a concept that we can find all through the Bible. It's couched in different terms, presented in different ways. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. And it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. There is rain, there is flood, there is wind in life, and it will reveal the kind of foundation we truly have. Now, everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on the house, and it fell. And great was its fall. It was a massive catastrophe. Building on the wrong foundation, pursuing the wrong priorities, using our time foolishly, will cause great ruin. And so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching. He gave it to them straight. He didn't pull any punches. He taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Are we building our houses on the rock or on the sand? What do we seek? What do we do with our time? I see a lot of silver hair out there in this congregation. We have many faithful members who've been in the Church of God for many years. And I can say for many of you, your examples have been an inspiration and are an inspiration to younger folks. I'm young enough still that there are people who knew me in the church as a child. And they will tell me stories about me sometimes. It makes me kind of nervous when I meet someone who says, "You know, I knew you when you were a teenager." Oh no, please don't go there and do that. But there are many of you here who are old enough and have enough of a track record in the church to be an inspiration to those who come after you. You are. You have built your houses on the rock. We see the priorities being expressed by your actions over a long track record. And we appreciate that. And we thank you for your examples. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4. Starting in verse 16, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, and he is for all of us, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. If we're focusing on that, our inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. You know the problem with that verse? Sometimes the affliction doesn't seem light at all. And sometimes it seems to stretch on forever, not fleeting. It doesn't feel that way. Sometimes it feels heavy, even crushing, and it seems like it won't end. But that's because we're stuck in the frame of reference that we have right now. And one day we're going to exit that frame of reference. And when we look back on the trials and the difficulties, the afflictions that we go through in this life that seem so grievous to us sometimes, looking back on them, they're going to seem light. Do they seem light now? Not always, no. But looking back on them, looking at them from God's perspective, they're going to seem light and very momentary. It's a struggle for us to keep that outlook, to have the vision that God has, but that's part of the Christian struggle that we're supposed to engage in. We've got to get our eyes up to see things the way God sees them. And that's not always easy. In fact, it's sometimes very difficult. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Now we have a vanity. Now we have a vapor that's passing by, and it's got some affliction. It's got a lot of good things, too, but it's got some affliction, and it lasts a while. But what's being achieved by that, under God's grace and guidance and the power of His Holy Spirit, is He preparing us for eternity, and not just eternity, but eternity in glory. So how we use each minute of each day is really, really important. Because what we do, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, through the days of our vanity, is preparing us for that future. That's the perspective that we absolutely have to keep. Verse 18, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. We're looking at promises that God gives us. We're looking at prophecies for the future. We're not just looking at the physical things that we can see and touch around us. Perishing outwardly, being renewed inwardly. We're going through this vapor of vanity, and we're being prepared for eternity in glory. The glory of the God family. The Apostle John said this in other words. It's interesting to look at the way he formulated it. Look at 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, starting verse 15. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. The fascinating summation of this life and what most people pursue in this life, how most people waste their time. John said, 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, and he sums it up in three things. This is basically what people pursue in the world. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, what looks good, what we would like to have, what dazzles us, what fascinates us, and the pride of life, wanting people to respect us, having a lot of Instagram followers because we're beautiful or cool or whatever. The pride of life. That's what it is. What would most young people like to be if they could be anything they wanted? Probably a sports star or a movie star. I think that's pretty safe to say. That's what a lot of people would like to be. In fact, that's probably what a lot of adults would like to be if they could be anything they wanted. Why is that? Because people look at you and they admire you, and you're sort of not a mere mortal anymore. People long to be respected like that and have people adulate them. Pride of life. And all of that is not of the Father. Those are not divine values, but is of the world. And he says the world is passing away. It's going to die out. This world is going to go extinct one day. And all the things that seem so important to people, they're all going to disappear, and they will be no more. The world is passing away, and the lust of it, the things that people want so badly, they're willing to do almost anything for it. On the other hand, he who does the will of God, and in this world that's a lot less impressive than other things, isn't it? Because that's we're seeking invisible things that other people can't see. But he who does the will of God abides forever. That's the comparison that we have. He who does the will of God abides forever in glory. Let me mention a few areas to consider in the light of what we've been seeing here, what the Bible tells us about the brevity of human life. Consider, please, your marriage. If you're married, consider the love, the appreciation, the companionship, the caring and sharing that that brings to your life. And what a wonderful blessing that is. God said it's not good for the man to be alone. It's hard. Hard for the man to be alone, or the woman to be alone. And if you have a marriage, especially if you have a pretty happy marriage, that is an immense blessing that God has given you. Do you really appreciate it? Do you tell your spouse how much you appreciate him or her? What sort of actions are showing in your marriage? What priorities are being expressed in your relationship with your spouse? We read Ecclesiastes 9:9, where it said, "Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life." That's one of the best things in life, is a happy marriage. And many people take that for granted. Or they make decisions in life that prevent them from having a happy marriage. They make poor decisions which make that difficult. And it's still possible to have a successful life without that, but what a blessing it is if you have a marriage like that. How about your children? Think about the brevity of life with your children. If you have young children, I have old children now. If you have young children, let me tell you something. You're not going to have them very long. You will be stunned how quickly they are out of the house and living their own lives. You will be stunned, believe me. So take advantage of the time you have with them. Don't let a day be wasted. Spend time with them. Enjoy their company and teach them. You have a short time to teach them very important things which can help them set the right foundation for their lives. Don't let that time get away from you. You know what it says in Ephesians 6, verse 4. Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. A lot of parents would like to have some of those days back again. They look back and they say, wow, I really wish I had done this. It's just, I can't believe they're there. I'm at the phase in my life now where I'm starting to say things and then I realize, wow, I heard my dad say that a few years ago. The cycle of life continues. It cycles on through. What about your friends? You appreciate the friendships that you have. That also is one of the great joys of life. Solomon talked about that, how good it is for iron to sharpen iron. Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel, it says in Proverbs 27:9. Isn't it a joy to sit around with a good friend and talk and just share things, maybe share memories or talk about the future or just talk about things that interest you, whatever your common interests are. That sharing is a wonderful thing. And we're going to be able to share things like that throughout all eternity. It's not good for people to be alone. Value your friendships. Verse 17 of Proverbs 27 says, I've mentioned it a moment ago, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. We can make each other better. We can build each other up and help each other. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9 and 10 says, two are better than one. That's Ecclesiastes 4:9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. Sometimes you can accomplish more with the two of you than you can individually. And for if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. Value your friendships. Value your friendships at church. Value other friendships that you might have. But I think we probably, most of us, have our strongest and deepest friendships within the faith. And those are valuable things. Those are wonderful blessings from God. What does this imply about your commitment and participation in the life of the church? Again, that's not a question I can answer for you, but I would encourage you to think about that too. We need to keep the proper balance in this. It's possible to be unbalanced in either direction. Sometimes in the early years of this era of the church, people served so much they ended up maybe neglecting other things that they shouldn't have, their families or time with their children or whatever. We don't want to go to that extreme. But we don't want to go to the other extreme either, which we sometimes see a little bit today. I think it's due partly to the internet. It's due partly to our church history, where people kind of disengage from the church. It's a sort of an arm's length relationship. I don't really need to go. There's so many sermons on the internet, good sermons. I don't think I'll go today. It's getting longer to go there. You should remember, it is a holy convocation. When you're convoked, it means you're supposed to, by lawful authority, present yourself there. Unless there's a very good reason why you can't. Illness or incapacity or something of that nature. It's important that we be a part of the life of the church. There's more to the holy convocation than just the sermon. There is fellowship with one another. And we owe it to each other. We really owe that to each other. Hebrews chapter 10. Now, I'm not saying this, please understand, because I think there's some particular problem in this region. I don't really know most of you very well. I'm just talking about a general trend in the church. So don't feel like I'm pointing this finger directly at you personally, unless you feel like it should be pointing at you directly personally, in which case you have my permission to feel that way. But do think it over. Ask yourself the question honestly, and look at the honest answer to those questions. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Hold fast to your confession, to the decisions and the commitments you made. Hold fast to those and don't waver in them. He who promised is faithful. Heard about that in the special music. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some. That's been a temptation since the first century. Some people fall into that habit. I don't really need to go today. But exhorting one another. What does it mean to exhort? It doesn't mean you set up your little lectern and you start lecturing, I'm exhorting you to do this. No, it means encouraging. Encouraging by our comments. Help people continue doing the right thing. Encouragement is a big need. We all need to be encouraged. When I was ordained as a very young minister, younger than we usually ordain them nowadays, I was a bit overwhelmed by the charge, and I went to my father, who was a longtime pastor even then, and I said, Dad, give me some advice. What should I concentrate on? How should I look at this responsibility that I have now? And I've never forgotten one of the things he told me. He said, I believe that what members of the Church of God need more than anything else is encouragement. Encourage people, he said. Try to be an encourager. And I took that to heart, and I have tried through my years in the ministry to always have encouragement in my messages. Now, I have not always succeeded, but it has been a goal. It's always been a goal. And I would encourage you to take that goal for yourself as well. Be an encourager. Encourage people. That's exhorting them in the right way. Encourage them to persevere in a trial. Encourage them to keep doing the right thing when it's hard to do that. Be an encourager. We really owe that to each other, exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Do you see the day approaching? When you watch the news in the light of the prophecies that we see in the Bible, do you see the day approaching? Then we should be doing this more, not less. Now, there are physical limitations. We get sick. Maybe it's too far for us reasonably to drive, etc., etc. But what about our commitment to the church of God and the head of that church, Jesus Christ, and the work that it is doing to help prepare a people for the kingdom of God? Look at Malachi chapter 3. There's a fascinating exchange here. In Malachi 3, see if you find this as interesting as I did. I find this really fascinating that God shares the fact that he's aware of something as... how should I put it? Something that happens as often as this. He's aware. Malachi chapter 3, verse 13. He said, your words... He's talking to his people now. This is God talking. Your words have been harsh against me. You talk about me harshly, says the Lord. Yet you say, what have we spoken against you? You have said, it is vain to serve God. It isn't worth it. There's not enough reward in it. It's too hard. I've been doing this all these years, and this is all I get. It's not fair. I've been faithful, and he won't get me out of this trial. God considers those harsh words. It is vain to serve God. What profit is it that we have kept his ordinances and that we have walked as mourners before the Lord of hosts? It's not worth it. So now we call the proud blessed. And I look out there, look at all those people that are going the wrong way, and they're rich. They got a big house, they got a sports car, and look at me. I'm trying to obey God, and this is all I get. Have you ever heard people say something like that? Have you ever had a little voice in the back of your mind whisper that to you? So now we call the proud blessed, and those who do wickedness are raised up. Yet those who tempt God go free. The world ain't fair. No, it isn't. We learned that pretty early on in life. I can remember complaining to my father one time, Dad, that's not fair. And you know what he said to me? He said, you know you're right, it's not fair. But when I was a boy, life wasn't fair to me. So if it were fair to you, it wouldn't be fair. He said things like that. How does God look at it? Verse 16. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. What were they talking to each other about? They were exhorting one another, encouraging one another to keep going the right direction. And a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. God takes names. He writes them down. He doesn't really need to do that. This is a metaphor here. He doesn't have a hard drive either. He just remembers. But he takes note. It said he takes note. He notes when we have conversations between ourselves and we encourage one another. That's precious to him. Instead of complaining about how unfair he is, etc., etc. Like Job did. Remember Job? Bad things happened to Job. He didn't understand. And he said, you owe me an explanation. You're not doing this right. And what was God's answer to him? If you get to the end of the book of Job, God doesn't say, well, here, let me explain it all to you, Job. I got to build character. You got some self-righteousness. And that's why all this. No. God just said, hey, Job, look, this is me. This is you. When you can build a universe like I did, you can tell me how to run it. But until that time, you're going to have to trust me. It's faith. Do we trust him or do we not trust him? Can you build a universe? I can't do it. So I'm going to have to trust him. And that's really the only reasonable thing to do. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels, that I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. Then you shall again discern between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and one who does not serve him. The judgment will come. Good will be rewarded. Evil will be punished. Those who persevere and are faithful to God and who trust him are going to be his jewels. And we do that with the minutes in our lives. We do that with the hours and the days and the things that we, the actions that express our priorities. So what are our priorities? As we get older, and sometimes younger too, because of the situations we've gone through in the church, our enthusiasm might dim a little bit. And if that's happened to you, please think about these things in the Bible. Please look at your life differently than whatever it is that's causing you to let down. We have a lot we can give back to each other, and that's a precious thing in God's eyes. We want to be zealously involved in the work of the Church of God. This is the first time I've ever quoted Mae West in a sermon. What she said was right, although not the way she intended it to be. You only live once, but if you do it right, once is enough. Isn't that true? No, she probably meant it in some other way. You only live once, but if you do it right, once is enough. It is. Once is enough for us to achieve the spiritual goals that God has set for us. Once is enough. He gives us enough time to do what we need to do. It's a question of priorities. I've sometimes sat with church members in the autumn of their lives as they see their days on earth drawing to a close. I've done this in hospital rooms. I've done it in living rooms. I've done it in church after services. And sometimes they want to sort of talk through their lives. And I listen a lot. And I've never heard one of them lament that they wish they'd made a little more money. Or that they wish they'd had a better career. Or that they'd had a bigger house. Or that they'd made that trip to Honolulu that they always wanted. I've never heard them lament anything like that. It's never happened even once. But I have heard many of them say they wish they'd spend more time with their loved ones. They wish they'd had a better relationship with their children. They wish their marriage had been stronger. Sometimes they say, I would really like to be able to go back to church one more time and sing hymns. Priorities. All about priorities. You only live once. But if you do it right, once is enough. James chapter 4, verse 13, as we close now. Sorry, it looks like I'm going to go a minute or two over time. James chapter 4, verse 13. James 4, 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. I've got my life all planned out. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even, here we see it again, it's a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. You don't know how much time you've got. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, getting your priorities wrong, I know I should be doing this, but this seems more fun or more interesting. To him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it's a sin. The question of priorities is very important in God's eyes. Don't put things off that need to be done, things that you know need to be done. Get going on it right away. Live each day as a precious gift from God. We will never have yesterday back to do over. We will never have today back to do over. We won't have tomorrow except on the day we live it. Let's come back to our question at the beginning of the sermon. If you knew you only had a short time left to live, what would you do differently? Well, the truth of the matter is, brethren, you do only have a short time to live. You don't know how short, but it is short. The older we become, the more we realize that even if we get our full 3 score and 10, even if we get all that, it's still going to be short. But what we do with the short time we have here in life determines what's going to happen in the life to come. So you can think of this principle as live like you were dying, or I prefer to say, God, teach us to number our days. Ask God to help you number your days, because, brethren, our days are numbered. And whether we meditate on that or not, we only have a limited amount of time. And we have so much to accomplish with each day. So make every one count.